Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone. I'm Leah Parody, professor of history at Slippery Rock University and co-host of Lies Agreed Upon, a partner podcast of the New Books Network about how Hollywood uses history to talk about today. I'm speaking with Peter Hughes, the author of A History of Love and Hate in 21 Statues, published in 2021 by Aurum. Dr. Hughes has a PhD in philosophy and is also a member of the British Psychological Society. He has worked with various populations in crisis and has written widely on a number of subjects. Welcome, Peter. It's good to be talking to you today.
Thanks very much, Leah. It's my pleasure to be here.
So, A History of Love and Hate in 21 Statues spans millennia and the globe, and it's a particularly timely book. The ongoing debate surrounding public commemoration, particularly in the form of statues and the names of streets and buildings, has become more heated over the past few years. So first of all, as we get started, I'd like to just ask you, given that you've explored this topic in great detail, why do you think the questions surrounding public forms of commemoration and validation have been so much a focus of the public's attention recently?
I think that's a great question. And first, we need to put a bit of historical context. I think that public memorials and statues have always been a bone of contention. I mean, my book goes way back to ancient Egypt and perhaps one of the greatest female rulers of the ancient world, the Pharaoh Hatshepsut, and right up to the present day. And that demonstrates really that there's been these struggles over identity, struggles over power, struggles over public memorials for thousands of years. And they tend to rise up and flare up at times where social divisions tend to increase. So there's a historian in the UK who wrote a great book called Black and British called David Olusoga. And he made the observation that generally he would walk around towns and cities, he wouldn't even notice the statues. They just kind of sit there in the background. And I certainly agree with that. I'm no great admirer or decrier of statues as such. They just sit there in the background of our lives. We walk through our towns and cities and they're there. And then suddenly some division comes up, usually between various identity groups or an event happens. In this case, it was the killing of George Floyd that really precipitated a wave of iconoclasm, not just in the United States, but also throughout many, particularly Western countries. And then we're forced really to address the issues that throws up. And you had extraordinary scenes all over the world, like in my country, the UK, although there was only one statue, as far as I'm aware, that was actually forcibly taken down. The police needed to put cordons around many others, including the statue of Winston Churchill. And there was one brilliant anecdote, actually, of a small old market town in the Midlands called Nuneaton. And near there was a group of people who wanted to tear down a statue associated with colonialism in one way, shape or form. But another group of people came to protect another statue in the town. And unknown to them, and they didn't know who she was, it was the statue of the novelist George Eliot. And so they obviously were surrounding this statue to protect it from iconoclasts and without necessarily knowing who the statue was about or what her significance was. But the very fact that it was a statue meant they had to defend it. And I think that goes to reflect really how divisive and how blind very often our impulses can become. And my book really is interested in how we become divided and what makes us venerate some icons and hate others and tear them down. And one minute we ignore them, and the next minute they jump into the forefront of our lives, and we have to say, right, that has to come down. It's oppressive. And other people say, no, we have to defend it. How dare you? It's our heritage. And then that's how things divide. There was a really interesting quote made by a woman called Sophia Nelson. She's a Black American woman, and commenting on Confederate statues. She's a journalist and a writer, and commenting on American statues. And she said, "I don't fear," she said, "150-year-old statues of dead white men. What I fear is the hatred we are seeing in real time in 2021 on social media," she said, "on our college campuses, in our workplace, and in our political rhetoric." And there really is the kernel of the debate. For some people, what matters is how do we keep ourselves together now? For others is how do we make ourselves accountable for the past? And that really is a fault line. It's a psychological fault line. And my book really explores a lot of the psychology really behind that kind of behavior, and which of course is ultimately fascinating because, as maybe we'll discuss later on, much of it is wrapped up in status displays. But that's maybe we can come on to that later.
Yes. I mean, it's an interesting idea, even thinking that we separate those two things out, that we either will venerate or will be tolerant. And perhaps the question, as we can get onto, is it the case that if we continue to venerate, then it's very difficult to foster tolerance? One of the things that that I want to make sure that our listeners understand is really the wide range of statues that you talk about. They range widely in terms of time, location, personage. You cover everything from the Bamiyan Buddhas to the first Prime Minister of Canada, who, as a Canadian, I can say is a pretty boring person. Given how many possible candidates you had to choose from, what made you select this particular collection of statues? Was there an overarching theme or a litmus test that helped you to narrow down your choices?
Yes, there was, and two things. First was violence. So each one of the statues in the book was taken down violently. So they were, and many of the chapters, almost all the chapters, begin with an account of the destruction of the statues. And some of them, of course, are particularly bloody. I mean, you know, and the idea behind that type of graphic description of the destruction of statues is because, as one commentator said about the destruction of the statue of the slave trader Edward Colston in Bristol in the UK, it could have been a human being they were dragging along the ground. And one of the statues, for example, the statue of Emperor Nero, which was discovered at the beginning of the 20th century in a riverbed, and was violently hacked, and the researchers were able to work out how it was beheaded, and these statues were literally mutilated. And there's one statue in particular, which was the statue of Athena in Palmyra, which was mutilated twice. Once by Christians in the 4th century, to black-robed zealots, as I call them, who came out of the desert and mutilated the statue and left her face down in the desert stands. And then in 2015, a second time by another bunch of black-robed zealots, the ISIS fighters who came into the ancient city of Palmyra and mutilated her again, what was left of her. And so you have, throughout the book, this unity in all the statues of this violence, really, that accompanies their destruction. So that was one thing that determined which statues got in the book. And the other was I wanted a geographical spread. they would go from, you know, all different parts of the world. So this isn't a uniquely Western phenomenon or a contemporary phenomenon. There's sometimes too much of a tendency in our own culture to imagine that history started 10 years ago, you know, that actually the roots of this kind of pathological behavior are very deep. They're deep in our history, and they're also deep in our genetic history, and they're deep in our history as a species. And so I wanted to reflect that. And also I wanted to reflect the diversity, really, of the statues. Some are men, some are women, and one's of an indigenous Aboriginal warrior. Another one is of the great abolitionist and Frederick Douglass. Another is of a slave trader like Edward Colston, or a Confederate monuments, which really were designed really to glorify the South and the antebellum South. And so we have this very wide range of statues, and it shows how ubiquitous this kind of behavior is, because what it really boils down to is those whom we love, we will tolerate and we will be generous towards. But the deeper our love, the deeper our hate. So in psychologically, you can put it like this: there is a strong correlation between high degrees of empathy and high degrees of cruelty. So if you have strong, and this has been really demonstrated by a number of psychological studies, but the basic principle of this is if you have a strong empathy towards an in-group, then you are, and the deeper that empathy goes, the more likely you are to have visceral hatred of people who are part of the out-group. Which is why, for instance, on social media, regardless of whether you're coming from the right or the left or the you know, whatever side of these debates you're on, it's quite common to see somebody hurling insults at somebody. Hateful, I hope you die, I hope your children die, then hashtag empathy. And there is no conflict. There is no psychological conflict between that. And we see that psychology in the destruction of statues. That those whom we venerate, those whom we love, we say, let them stand. Those whom we hate, tear them down. But not just tear them down, let's mutilate them. Let's decapitate them. Let's cut off their limbs. Let's throw them into a harbour. Let's humiliate them. Because really, it's a kind of vicarious humiliation of those we consider to be our ideological enemies.
Well, that's really interesting, because it also suggests to me that those who feel that no empathy or love has been directed towards them from the group represented in the statue, that then also means that the statue is sort of standing in for the perpetrators of the hate that is felt by a group of people who have been sort of on the outs. And maybe that takes us to the next question, which is that you know, in your range of statues, they have a really broad range of meaning for the people who encountered them every day before their destruction. And so, in doing your research and thinking through these processes, what did you note about, for example, the relationship between the community and a statue that had been erected, you know, centuries before or decades before or only a few years before its destruction? You quoted the historian who, you know, says, oh, these gray and boring statues that I walk past and I sort of don't note them, that you know, does that have any kind of a correlation to sort of how long the statue's been there, what the makeup of the community is now versus what it was when it was erected? You know, I'm just curious about what you find about those components of the dynamic.
No, I don't think it has any bearing on how long the statue's been there. It has a bearing on where contemporary culture and politics are. So, some statues have been objects of contention from the moment they came up. The slave trader Edward Colston, for example, in Bristol in the UK, being one of those. He was at the top of the Royal African Company, and he was responsible for the transportation and death of thousands of black Africans. But this is what's curious about people like that. He also devoted in his will, his legacy was to devote all his money to philanthropic causes. And we have this in human beings that none of us are either wholly evil or wholly good. And you see it among the robber barons, for instance, people like Andrew Carnegie, you know, who would, you know, exploit his workers in one instance, actually sanctioning their killing. And he'd exploit their workers for every single cent they earned. And then he would go and devote his profits to building libraries and facilities for the poor. And so human beings are nuanced. And this is a key point that comes up in the book. And there are two particular really interesting points here. One is that I talk about Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. when he said there's some of the best in the worst of us, and there's some of the worst in the best of us. And when you can take that kind of nuanced perspective, that makes you truly human. It makes you capable of compassion, because it's very difficult to hate from that kind of position. And to give you another idea, right, in this case of a black African who, of course, was celebrated for his campaign against apartheid, Nelson Mandela. When he came out of prison, he put his name to 10 scholarships, and he called them the Mandela Rhodes Scholarships. Now, Cecil Rhodes was a white supremacist, and he devoted his life really to amassing a fortune through often very brutal and violent colonial behavior. There's a whole campaign in this country to topple statues of Cecil Rhodes called Rhodes Must Fall. It began in as a campaign in South Africa. Yet Nelson Mandela puts his name to a scholarship, and you just think, well, why would he do that? And he said, we have to stop, said Mandela, the circle of hate. We have to close the circle, because we just can't go on putting evil all in one camp and good all in another. Because going back to Martin Luther King, there's some of the best in the worst of us and some of the worst in the best of us. And when facing what to do with apartheid statues in post-apartheid South Africa, Mandela, some of the most egregious ones were removed, some were reinterpreted, and some were left standing. But the idea was, and he said this, there are some people, he said, who are villains to us, who are heroes to other people. There are some people who are heroes to other people who are villains to us. We have to reconcile that. We have to find a way to pull ourselves together. And as one South African legislator at the time said, you can't heal old wounds by making new ones. And I look at the cultural landscape, really, and so much of meaning and identity is wrapped up in the virulence with which we can demonize and hate those with whom we disagree. And in my experience, I've worked in often very violent circumstances in the past, and I've worked with extreme forms of conflict resolution. You can always find common ground, but you've got to take some risks, and you have to concede something. And this then throws onto another thing that's psychologically interesting, which is, having mentioned the empathy-cruelty correlation, there's also a strong correlation between status and signalling one's virtue. And these are very deeply embedded, really, in our psychology, and they're deeply embedded in our biology as well as in our history and our culture. And so sometimes by where victimhood and virtuous victimhood can accrue. There's a wonderful study published in the Journal of Social Psychology in 2020, which found this correlation between virtuous victimhood and the gaining of two types of reward. One was material rewards. You might get more money, more funding, more educational opportunity. But the key one was symbolic rewards, which was status, a sense of belonging, a sense of being loved, a sense of being validated. And of course, you only need to look at social media on all sides of the political divide, and these technologies are extremely divisive, and they encourage us to become increasingly polarized, and that polarization then results in more acknowledgement and more status. And so, when we come to tear statues down, what are we really doing? You know, we walked past those statues for a long time. Why do they come down now? Even if we protest them, and I'm making no argument that all statues should stand. That's not what the book is about. I'm not coming up with it. These should stand or these should fall. There's some statues I find particularly egregious, and I've got no problem in saying that. But what interests me is the bloodlust, really, that often lies behind mob violence. And a classic case in my book was the statue of Confucius in 1966 in the Chinese city of Kufu. And this was at the beginning of the Cultural Revolution, where the Red Guards, it was shortly after the first teacher had been murdered at one of the elite schools in Beijing. She was beaten to death with a spike club and her body thrown in a garbage can. And the elite, and it was always the elite, this was an elite movement. It was a movement in elite educational institutions. And they broke into the ancestral home of Confucius in Khufu, and they destroyed lots of statues. They dug up some of Confucius's ancestors. They hung the bodies from a tree. One witness at the time complained about the stench of the bodies was still strong. They looted the graves of all sorts of children. They dragged Confucius. They reserved a special punishment for the statue of Confucius. They put a dunce's cap on it, which of course is mirroring the struggle sessions that were to be such a fundamental part of the Cultural Revolution, dragged his body through the streets, made his followers walk behind him as they beat them. And they also wore placards confessing their anti-revolutionary crimes. And then they eventually cast the statue of Confucius onto a fire. And so this is where these kind of extreme degrees of allegiance and extreme degrees of exclusion take us. And what Mandela, what Martin Luther King are asking us to do is just to pause. It might be a little more nuanced than we think. And let's rediscover our common humanity before we collapse everything.
It's really interesting to think about the sort of bloodlust that is associated with inanimate objects, and to think of them as sort of these distillations in the imagination of those who are destroying them of so much, right? They become these vessels for so much that is actually separate from that particular person or image or statue or location. Yeah.
It's heady, you know, when mobs, and I quote here a number of people in the book who warn against, once mobs form, we disindividuate ourselves, you know, and we become capable of doing stuff that outside of the context of a mob, you just think, how did I do that? What on earth was I thinking of? How did I get carried away to that point? And we see this when I talk about the Confederate monuments. I talk about some of the work of Ida B. Wells and some of the horrific lynchings that she describes in her Red Report, and the way that people would gather together and witness. And of course, this brings us back to one of the people I'm really fascinated with, both as a historian and as a philosopher, the work of the French. I guess you'd call him a post-structuralist, post-modernist, but it's a bit of a misnomer. Michel Foucault, and of course Foucault at the beginning of Discipline and Punishment talks about the spectacle of punishment, and gives this incredibly graphic account of a regicide who is brutally executed, and how the mob that formed around him, and of course that again is something that runs through this book. You know, when the bloodlust is high like that, the difference between destroying a statue and killing a person really becomes blurred. And in some instances, of course, in the book, that indeed happened. And I talk about, there's a wonderful American anthropologist called Christopher Boehm, S-B-O-E-H-M, and he talks about how our primal instincts, how there's some things that are human universals, like war, ethnocentrism. We always tend to think our culture, our beliefs are the best ones, blood revenge, you know, raiding, particularly for our objects of value, and given that most of the raiding was done by men, many of the raiding was to assassinate other men and to capture and rape the women. And these are human universals. And when you see so much of the violence that surrounds the destruction of statues, you can see that. But of course, the counter argument to that is somebody says, yeah, well, that's fair enough. But why should we have to tolerate a Confederate statue in the middle of our town? In the middle of our city? I mean, W.E.B. Du Bois, you know, famously said that if you're going to have a Confederate monument, you should have on the base of it, sacred to the memory of those who fought to perpetuate human slavery. You should have those words at the bottom of every Confederate monument. And then the counter argument to that by those who support those monuments still standing is that, yeah, but it's about heritage, not hate. Yeah, this is not, we're not glorifying, we don't want the return of slavery, but we're just honoring our ancestors, right? So how do you square that circle?
Well, it's interesting because what you mentioned when you're juxtaposing the actual lynchings of Black bodies and the erection of a statue of a statue that's erected to a white Confederate general or soldier, whatever, that then people want to bring down. Really, in those two things, the difference is power, right? That white people had the power to actually lynch Black bodies. Black people have now perhaps for a moment the power to pull down a statue. And that, I think, that's something I wanted to ask you about because, the title of your book, A History of Love and Hate in 21 Statues, suggests that the motivation for public commemorations, as well as the opposition to them and in much of what you've been talking about, which comes out of your work and your, your specific areas of examination and expertise, that these things can be found first and foremost in a society's emotional relationship to the person or the god, for that matter, who's being commemorated. But I found this approach kind of interesting because it suggests that the power dynamics that are at play in the decision-making process aren't really as important as the emotions. But isn't power, in essence, the power to define things? And the statues reflect that power to basically set the definition of someone as worthy or not, beloved or not, and that, therefore that perhaps whoever they directed their negative energies towards is therefore sort of powerless in that environment.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And I think that the differentiation between power and the emotional component that sustains it here is not an easy one to make. I'll go back here to Michel Foucault because he is really the philosopher or the historian of power, and he said very famously in an introduction to a book by Gilles Deleuze and Félix Guattari called *Anti-Oedipus: Capitalism and Schizophrenia*. And he said we've got to beware. He said the fascism in us all. He said that causes us to love power, to desire the very thing that dominates and exploits us. So here we have a link being made between power and veneration, power and love. But what's important to remember about power, nobody has it. And Foucault is unquestionably correct on this. For Foucault, power just circulates. Nobody owns it. It's a complete myth to believe that, a certain group of people, be they a certain class or a certain gender or a certain race, actually own power. It flows through them and it circulates at various historical moments. They will have the capacity to utilize those flows to demonstrate their dominance over subordinate groups. And that's unquestionably the case. Of course, statues are symbols of the dominant culture, but power doesn't always have to be tyrannical. So you can argue that, in the case of Confederate statues, clearly, they are probably the most complex and egregious forms of statues, really. And there was an evolutionary biologist called Jerry Coyne, and he came up with what he calls Coyne's dictum. And he said, if you're going to decide which statue should stand or fall, look at the intent behind those who put them up. So intent actually matters. And what people don't realize is most Confederate monuments weren't put up in 1860. That the peak Confederate monument building decade was 1910 to 1920. And gradually these monuments migrated from where they were placed initially, which was in cemeteries, and they migrated into town squares. And of course, as the decades passed and Jim Crow laws took place and lynchings took place, there were lynchings at the base of many of these statues, and they became unquestionable symbols of white supremacy. There's no, I think even the most ardent supporter of Confederate monuments would struggle to make the argument that they were in anything other than symbols of white supremacy. And so I think that that, and in that sense, they were symbols of course, symbols of a certain type of power. But that power isn't uniform. Sophia Nelson, I quoted earlier, a Black American journalist, supports the retention of Confederate monuments. She says she deplores the Confederate flag, but when it comes to monuments, she says no. They should stand, she said, because they're a reminder, she said, of what we are not. They're a reminder of the progress we've made. You know, and also she says quite correctly, on this point she's correct, when you start removing the most egregious statues, or where do you stop? It's a bit like the free speech issue. By all means, look at somebody like Alex Jones, the conspiracy theorist who so we look at him and any reasonable person would say, well, he's pretty malevolent. So, okay, we can understand if he's cancelled. But actually, by pointing to the most egregious, we then have what's called concept creep, or what a wonderful study done at Harvard University defined by a team of psychologists as prevalence-induced concept change. That the more the prevalence of something decreases, the more we expand the concept of it to make it look as if there's no difference. So to translate that into, say, discrimination, or the less discrimination there is, the more we expand the concept of what constitutes discrimination, so it looks as if not only that we're making no progress, but things are getting worse. So we have all these complex issues flow into it, and that's another point that she makes. And she also says if you're going to fight racism, you've got to put it in its context, and this is the context. This was the history. So, and other people will say, well, let's leave those Confederate monuments standing, but let's reinterpret them. And people can reinterpret monuments in all sorts of incredibly imaginative ways. The best one I ever saw was a Soviet war memorial in Sofia in Bulgaria. And I recommend anybody to look this up. And protesters painted over the Russian soldiers as superheroes. Like there was Superman and Batman and what was Santa Claus. And it's hilarious. And it's a wonderful mechanism to reinterpret a statue. Then, of course, some people would wipe it off and then they'd put it back on again. So these choices are not simple, but we must ask ourselves two questions before we consider upending the ground on which we sit. Firstly, who are we to judge? And I quote in the book, although I'm a humanist myself, I quote the very famous incident from the Gospel of John where Jesus is in the town square and the priests come up to him and they say, we've caught this woman in adultery. We've caught her in flagrante. You've got to condemn her. We're going to stone her to death. And of course, it's a double bind, because if Jesus says, yes, you must stone her to death, then he can't be doing anything new. He's one of them. But if he says no, well, he could also be stoned to death. So he does a wonderful response, which is, let him who is without sin cast the first stone. And which again really echoes Nelson Mandela, it echoes Martin Luther King Jr. And so we firstly have to think, well, who are we to judge? And let us, as Foucault tells us to do, let us look at our own love of power. Let us look at how power moves us. And let's not divide the world so easily into victims and perpetrators. Because now another person I quote when I talk about the statue of the Jewish composer, although he converted to Lutheranism, but the Felix Mendelssohn, I quote in there the guy, Rabbi Harold Kushner, who wrote a wonderful book, When Bad Things Happen to Good People. And he said, we are all, he said, brothers and sisters in suffering. And when we see our own suffering in somebody else and somebody else's suffering in us, it humanizes us. When also we see other people's intolerance and other people's hate and other people's cruelty, and we see ourselves as being capable of the same thing, it humanizes us, because we are no different. The people who were lynching Black Americans under Confederate monuments, the people who ran the gas chambers at Auschwitz, you know, the people who were for part of Stalin's secret police, the Romans who executed so many Britons and all the empire builder. How are we so different from them? We have the same brain, the same nervous system, the same genetics. We too are capable of unspeakable horror. And if we want to find a way out of the morass that we're in, we first need to see the fascism inside us all and deal with that first. That means when we act, we will act in a humane way and with the best of intentions and with an understanding that we may not be better than those that we condemn.
Well, that's very eloquently put, but I wonder whether in being so egalitarian, it does perhaps remove some of that motivation that you sort of spoke about a few minutes ago. Like you said that it's very important to understand in our discussion of removing monuments to people or naming of buildings or streets or whatever, to be thinking of what the motivation was in erecting that to begin with. And so then I guess it makes me question whether it's possible to perhaps use that as one of the tools by which we differentiate so that we're not, as you say, having concept creep, but rather that we can have a subtlety to our approach. And so if the very reason for the erection of a monument, or if the very reason why an institution that has the name of somebody over it, a doorway is there, is on the backs of other people, that perhaps that might be where we say, yes, looking at motivation might actually be a way to help us to decide which ones should be renamed or which ones should be brought down. And I love, just to circle back to, because I think this sort of connects to it too, I love the notion, because I mean, as a historian, I'm obviously very familiar with people like Andrew Carnegie and the dichotomy of people like Andrew Carnegie or Colston or Rhodes or any of those. But I love the notion of thinking of their work as virtue signaling, because really, in essence, that's what all of that philanthropic effort was, is that it was simply the virtue signaling of incredibly powerful people.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. But there was a wonderful a book written by a team of biologists. I think they were called Amots and Zahavi and Abhishek Zahavi, and it was called The Handicap Principle. And what they were interested was, they looked at birds, in this case, the Arabian babbler, and they were fascinated by the fact that here is somebody who warns other birds to whom he is not genetically related to, and in the process of doing so, risks his life. Why would a bird do that? But that's because there is status in virtue. And it doesn't matter whether it's Carnegie or the people tearing down the statue of John A. MacDonald in Montreal. Yeah, because when that statue came down, it was beheaded as it fell, and one of the protesters jumped on the head and pretended to urinate on it, and there was all general festivity. And of course, the virtue signaling is very strong, and what you're really saying there is, I am nothing like this man. Well, I would question that. Yeah, I mean, whether the statue should stand for, whether it should move, be reinterpreted is one issue. But the key issue is, how are we different? And what we have to acknowledge is not that we, therefore, we never make any change, because you have to have some agitation to make change. To get the vote in this country, the suffragettes had to agitate. You know, to break apartheid, there had to be agitation. You know, we can't live in a world where we all just sit back and wait for change to happen. That's not going to be the case. But what we have now, what we have to be wary of more than anything, is utopianism. That by all means, let's agitate for a change in this area or in that area. Let's agitate to have change that everybody has healthcare, for instance. Everybody has the right to decent healthcare. That's worth fighting for, right? We don't just sit down and say, well, there's nothing we can do about it. Maybe we're as bad as they are, so we'll just let it pass. So by all means, but the challenge we have, and this is the way you see things like with the statue of Confucius and these kind of very ideologically driven movements, is where they say, let's tear everything down. Let's literally rip up the ground under our feet. And out of this, we will have a utopia, what I call a utopia of equity. Well, that is the road to hell. That really is. That is how you open the gates of hell. And if history teaches us anything, and biology teaches us anything, is that is the road to hell. But actually, if we want to agitate for specific change, well, let's do it. And let's not forget, it's those agitations that have led us, and the very values of some of the founding fathers, for example, in the United States, is precisely what's led us to this position now, so that we can look back at them and we can say, well, okay, guys, some of what you were doing then really wasn't great. You were slave owners, and that wasn't great. But the values, your belief in liberty, freedom of expression, the right of everybody for the pursuit of happiness, blah, 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 is what's informing us and allowed us to expand our circle of concern and expand our rights. It is only 50, 60 years ago that in this country, Alan Turing, who worked at Bletchley Park, who has largely played a huge part in decoding many of the German messages, was instrumental in helping us win the war in some respects, where he had to choose between imprisonment or chemical castration simply because he was a homosexual. It is only in 1967 that homosexuality was made legal in the United Kingdom. It is only in 1973 that homosexuality was taken out of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders as a mental disorder. So, and that is progress. And what's driven that progress is the very values that underpin our society, because it allows for that progress, which is why, and I come to the last statue I talk about in the book, Frederick Douglass wrote that great piece in called What to a Slave is the 4th of July. When he, and the vast bulk of that piece is all about, the 4th of July is nothing to a black man, to a black person. It's all about white supremacy. Then he reaches the end and he says, but he said, the American Constitution and those values are the best hope we have of making progress. And he has been proved correct. And I end the book by saying, when Frederick Douglass's own statue was taken down, we don't know who did it. And it could have been people from the far right who were moaning and protesting about their Confederate monuments being taken down. Or it could have been somebody from the left thinking, how dare he stand up for the American Constitution and, as Frederick Douglass did, give succor and go visit his former slave owner, on his Thomas Auld, on his deathbed. But what Douglass and Martin Luther King and Nelson Mandela and all these people inspire us to do is, yes, let's agitate for change, let's protest, but let's remember that we have the mechanism for gradual, progressive, positive change, and the evidence of what's happened. And I gave the example here of homosexuality and gay rights. If you look at the movement from the 1950s to now, it's seismic. And what's allowed that is the values that underpin our society. So we should be careful before we tear the ground underneath our feet. And I make a distinction between agitating for change and agitating to tear that ground up.
Well, and that is a great way for us to, great place for us to end our conversation at the end of the book and at the end of our time. It's been really great talking to you, and I really found the book very thought-provoking and a really interesting. And also, I would like to make sure listeners are aware, a very breezy read, given the heaviness of the subject matter. I think it's important to kind of to note that it actually is a big book that you can pick up and put down. You don't need to read from start to finish. You can look at particular figures and statues, and so it's a very worthwhile read. So thank you, Peter, very much for joining me.
And thank you very much, Leah. Much appreciated. Thank you.